This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Today, The Conversation Hour is going to save you money, potentially, when it comes to healthcare. What's costing you the most in healthcare? Maybe you've got tips of how to save money when it comes to medicines and your health. I'm Mary Guerin, and so in this conversation hour, I'm going to be joined by Elizabeth Devaney from Consumer Health Forum. She says there are lots of things in place that allow us to save money in the healthcare system, but they're not widely communicated. She's here to help. These are things in dental, in medicines, in getting to your doctor. So soon you can hop on the line if you have a question or indeed if you have a tip. This morning we also find ourselves at an intersection, if you like, of news stories about our roads. More than $1 billion going towards fixing the state's road network. Most of that is going towards regional roads. How do you feel about that? Among a range of things, they're filling in potholes. Maybe you've got a prime contender for this money. Maybe you can tell us about that pothole that you'd like to put at the top of the government's queue. This is all part of a pre-election sweetening push. Does it sway your vote? Let me know about the potholes in your life, whether this is going to sway your vote when it comes to the state election. At the same time, we've heard that the bitumen that we can use potentially in these potholes, is set to be of lower quality because our usual supply that's made for Australian conditions is being held up by the Middle Eastern war. That's an issue. Also, in this intersection of stories, we learn that motorcyclists are going to be using bus lanes along some of our busiest roads, and that's to save lives. So we're wondering this morning also, are our roads actually becoming safer? What do you think? There's this collision, if you like, of factors. We've got free public transport. Are you noticing the roads are less crowded and therefore safer? So we can maybe even slow down to go around those potholes? Have we got less road rage because it's a little bit easier out there? Are we having fewer accidents? What are you feeling about the roads? Tell me about the potholes in your neighbourhoods, and we'll be checking in to see if there's any basis with an ex-safety expert who can tell us whether this combination of fuel crisis and pre-election sweetening and free public transport have all combined to make us safer. Talking about being safe, King Charles and Queen Camilla are feeling safe, keeping calm and carrying on their tour of the US, even though we've had that shooting. A shooter, at least, got shockingly close to the US president and senior officials overnight. But that royal tour is going ahead. This hour we'll be talking about just how fraught and potentially awkward and yet important this tour is for the UK and the US. Also this hour, you'll hear from our marathoning legend, Mona, the first official sub-2-hour marathon. Wow. Just how quick are marathons going to get? All that this hour. But next, are our roads getting safer, or is that wishful thinking?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Are our roads actually getting safer? I'm joined by Professor Stuart Newstead, Director of the Monash Accident Research Centre. Hi, Stuart.
Good morning, Mary.
What do you think? There are a few, as I said, a few different stories going around at the moment. Let's go first to this $1 billion to go to make our roads safer, to resurface them, to fill potholes. Just how unsafe are our roads when it comes to things like potholes? How many accidents are caused by them?
Well, it depends what sort of road user groups, and it varies. When we're talking about motorcycles and motorcycle safety, road condition has been shown in the research to have a very strong correlation with likelihood of crash and the severity of crashes that happen. So maintaining road surface for motorcyclists is incredibly important. When we talk about car drivers, the link between road condition and safety is not so clear. And in fact, often the better we make the road surface for a car driver, often the faster they'll drive, so it can have some unintended safety disbenefits.
So all these potholes have been keeping us safe? well, if we're in a car.
They've certainly been slowing us down a bit. I mean, there can be safety concerns for people swerving around potholes and losing control, and potentially if they damage their car, having to pull off on the side of the road and being vulnerable. But these, as a overall safety effect, are relatively small. So the road maintenance issue is more about damage to vehicles than necessarily being a direct safety issue. But certainly that's something that is important for people who have had their cars damaged to not sustain that.
Yes, indeed. Tell us if you've got a road near you that needs fixing or a pothole we'd like to tell us about. Do you agree that, swerving around them has, or indeed not swerving around them, has that cost you money? Tell us about it. Also, you were mentioning there, Stuart, the motorcycles. One of those stories is about motorcycles being able to use bus lanes when it's busy. Now, how big a problem has this been, the swerving of motorcycles, especially when it comes to these bigger roads?
Well, I think the motivation for this change here is about separating motorcycle traffic from regular car traffic. And in principle, that is a very good concept, because motorcycles and regular vehicles, and particularly bigger vehicles like trucks, SUVs, don't mix very well. So keeping them away from each other, in principle, has a good safety benefit. I guess what we have to be mindful of, that it doesn't, for example, put motorcyclists in vulnerable positions if they're coming to clearways, for example, and they're able to scoot through and someone's missed the idea of the motorcycle coming through the bus lane and then turns in front of them. So that's something I think needs to be considered for safety. But we haven't really seen this as an initiative, so the evidence on how much it will improve motorcycle safety is a little bit in the air. And obviously, if you're doing this, you need to follow up with some research to make sure it's achieving its intended benefits.
So it's an experiment, and it's only applying to some roads. Does that make it more unsafe then, as you say, if it's not top of people's minds, if it's not consistent across the road network?
Possibly, but as being an experiment, it's really hard to understand exactly what benefit it will have. But I say, being turn-across type crashes where people are going through clearways and might have a motorcyclist coming through in a bus lane that they miss could be quite catastrophic, but how often that will happen will remain to be seen if it's rolled out.
You're listening to Professor Stuart Newstead. We're talking about the safety of our roads in a few different ways. Also, I'm asking you about the potholes in your life. There are a lot of texts coming through, Stuart, talking about, yes, the potholes should just be fixed. It shouldn't be part of an election campaign. We've had three rims stuffed so far. And this question, who's responsible for maintaining and who pays for the damage to our vehicles? Stuart, this is it seems to be, tapping a vein, if you like, of anger of our roads. How do we compare, I guess, state by state? I've got another text coming in saying that when you get out of the state, the roads are much better. How dangerous are our roads overall, comparatively?
Well, if you talk about Victorian roads in general, Victoria has one of the best safety records across the country. So our approach to road safety more generally here is actually very good. This is an issue that probably sits on the periphery. I understand it's very infuriating for people to have their cars consistently damaged, and it does cost people a lot of money. And it's a combination of state and local government funding that goes towards maintaining roads. But certainly many of the other things we are doing in the state in terms of road safety are very effective, and our rate of road trauma per population is one of the lowest in the country.
And is our free public transport affecting the safety of our roads, the number of accidents, the collisions and so forth?
Well, what you'd hope with free public transport is that it encourages people to take public transport for their commute. But some of the initial studies that are coming out are showing that this may not actually being achieved. So people aren't changing their commute patterns. They're tending to drive and continue to drive they're driving, because the idea of switching, particularly for commuting, to public transport is not only about cost, it's about amenity and convenience as well. And often they find that people don't really have the option to switch to a public transport mode that is convenient for them without extending their trip to work.
So that surprises me. Not, it doesn't hold true even for, you know, the inner urban areas, which are comparatively blessed by having that public transport?
Well, it doesn't change them particularly, because often in the inner urban areas, people are using public transport already. So all it just does is reduce their cost, which is part of the intention of the process. But what the studies, I believe, have found is that it's inducing exposure for recreational travel. People go off and go for a free trip to Ballarat for the weekend or something. They'll jump on the train. So the passenger volumes on those sort of services have gone through the roof, which in some respects is not actually pleasing the country people, because the trains are full all the time.
Yes, but it's always nice to visit Ballarat.
Rita,
you've called in from South Yarra. What did you want to say?
Hi, I'm a vendor writer. It was maybe a year ago where...
Oh, Rita, you're just breaking up a little bit there. I'm not sure if you can do anything. I think you said you're a Vespa rider.
Yes, I'm a Vespa rider. And I Vespa around, I guess. There was an occasion where there was a truck that came veered into my lane. So in order to avoid injury, I veered into the bus lane. Cautiously, of course, there were no buses. But there was police further up, and then they pulled me over and fined me.
Oh, no. And did you say, well, what about that truck?
Yep, I did. They did not care.
Yeah, okay. So you welcome, potentially, this move?
Oh, look, it'd be great just to avoid accidents or potential accidents like that, because it happens all the time. And if I'm going to get fined for saving my life, you know,
that seems
not
fair.
Right, either.
Yeah, that's right. Rita, thank you. That's really interesting insight, Stuart. Potentially, this is going to be already, Rita's saying, you know, she had to do that to save her life. So do you expect that it will have some sort of effect on the road toll?
Well, I say the intent of it is very good, because, as Rita points out, separating motorcycles from the rest of the traffic, in theory, should have quite a substantial safety benefit if it achieves that. But because it hasn't been done before, it's something we really need to have a look at and make sure that it's achieving that intended benefit. But I say, in theory, it actually seems like a reasonably good initiative.
Mm. I must ask you, Stuart, this is also a morning where we found out that the bitumen that's coming to Australia is not up to our normal standards. That's because the supply line has been disrupted by the war in the Middle East. What effect do you think that is going to have on safety?
That's very hard to tell, as Michael Catalbiano said in your article. If it makes the roads degrade quicker, then that could be problematic if they're not keeping up. But again, the link between safety and road condition for regular car drivers is tenuous anyway. And I think we've seen some adaptions of all sorts of standards. So the fuel standards have changed as well, so we can increase local production of diesel, for example. Will that change broader health outcomes is something we really remain to be seen. I think when we do these things in response to crisis, what's really important is to be able to actually study them and study the benefits and disbenefits, so we can learn from the future. These are unprecedented times, and we need to be learning to make sure that we adapt in the future better.
That these experiments might pay off, but you need to know. I mean, just finally, Stuart, what would you say are your top priorities, your top three things that we should be doing? If not those experiments, what should we be doing in terms of safety?
Well, we need a cohesive road safety strategy to make sure that we understand where our key problems are, what the risks are that are driving those problems, and how to identify those risks effectively. So having a really cohesive process that's scientifically informed and evidence-based is critical for improving road safety. We know there's still a lot of design flaws on our road in terms of how the roads are designed. There's a lot of incompatibility between speed limits and now traffic volumes and road design standards. There's still behavioural problems, drug and alcohol problems remain out there. So all those things really need to be addressed as part of a cohesive strategy to make sure that we're driving our road toll down. So it's about reducing risk, and it's about reducing risk faster than our exposure through population growth is increasing. And if we can manage that balance, we will see gains.
Professor Stuart Newstead, thank you so much for joining me today.
No problem at all.
Stuart is director of the Monash Accident Research Centre. Fiona, you've you've had some bad experiences on the roads in Mount Evelyn, is that right?
I'm not in Mount Evelyn. I come from the country originally, and I went for a major trip off the freeways on a route I used to use, you know, growing up. The roads were terrible. There was a particular major road that was, you could only travel at 40 k's an hour, and I could not believe the deterioration in those country roads that we just don't know about.
So do you think this is going to sway your vote? This is part of a pre-election kind of sweetening package.
I think it will definitely confirm my vote, but it also might sway country people's vote. The other thing I wanted to bring up is that when I was growing up, I remember around Braybrook, there used to be a road that was made out of concrete. And it was done, my father said, because of the war and the scarcity of materials. And I just wondered whether that could be considered.
Interesting. So that's one thought. Thank you, Fiona. Also, this online about country roads. Yes, they've deteriorated over the past 10 years. Cheap little patches last a month at best. That's in agreement with you, Fiona. And also, I drove to Deniliquin a few weeks ago, took my wife's hybrid. I saved $150 in diesel, but spent $165 on a new tyre because there was a pothole in the middle of a dual lane highway outside of Nagambie. Anthony, so sorry to hear that. Keep those conversations and those texts coming in about potholes and road safety. We will get to more if we have time. But coming up next, we're going to potentially be saving you money on healthcare.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Elizabeth Devaney is CEO of the Consumer Health Forum, and she is here to save you money. That's always a great day when that happens. Hello, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Mary.
You are going to talk about the things that we might not know that are in place already, nothing new, but they're just not widely known or well communicated. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Why aren't they well communicated?
Well, I think our health system is terrific, but it's like a labyrinth, right? It's so complicated. And so sometimes if you haven't been into a space, you don't realise what's available to help you.
Can you tell us, before we go to specific examples, is there anywhere that we can find out these tips that, you know, you can go to one place and see everything in our healthcare? Or is that why it's so difficult?
The short answer is no.
Right.
There are some good places to start, like with your local healthcare providers, but there isn't one place where you'll find everything out.
So what are some of these examples? I guess what are the ones that, you know, most people could benefit from?
So most of us know about the PBS. The government pays some money to help us with our medicines. But there is also a safety net, and that kicks in once you've spent enough on your prescriptions in a year, and then your medicines get much cheaper.
How much do we have to before we get that?
Yeah, so if you're paying that $25 a prescription, you have to pay about $1,700, and then those will drop off after that to about $7 per prescription. If you're on a concession card, it's $277 worth of prescriptions before they become free.
So I'm not going home and tallying them up. How do I find out how much I've spent?
Yeah, so what a lot of people do is they go to the one pharmacy and they ask that pharmacy to register them for the safety net. That pharmacy keeps a track of your prescriptions and will let you and the government know when you hit that amount.
Should everybody be doing that? I mean, because I guess we just don't know what's going to come in the next year, for instance.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea because it is calendar year. So in January, you might feel fantastic and then by September, you might have spent $500 on prescriptions.
Yeah, well, and I guess that would come up pretty quickly. And you're not thinking about it at the time. So your first piece of advice would be potentially go to your pharmacy, sign up for the safety net.
Yep.
Are all pharmacies doing it?
Yes.
It's free of charge?
Yes.
Shouldn't be a problem?
No, they're paid to help you with that, so it should be easy to do.
Should be easy to do. Let's write that down. Hold Elizabeth to it. 1300 222 774. Elizabeth Devaney is here. She's from the Consumer Health Forum, saving us money. So there's the PBS safety net. And I guess most medications would get up to a level where you have to pay that?
Yeah, so they are on the PBS medicines, though. So if you're getting right. something separately through, say, a private prescription, something that's not on the PBS, that won't be counted. But things that are on the PBS, which is most the most common medicines, absolutely will count.
Yep. And you are talking about the dental system as well. Mm. Now, I know from talking to people just how tricky it is to get dental care, let alone cheaper dental care. How can we do it?
So for kids, there is a scheme for children under 17 that the government will pay you a bit over $1,000 over 2 years for things like checkups, cleaning and other procedures if you get that family tax benefit A. So if you are getting that support from the government, you should definitely check MyGov or ask your dentist about it.
So can you describe the people will know whether they're getting that tax benefit?
Yeah, the government does send you a letter, but a lot of people, I think, if they're anything like me, there are letters that get opened quickly and they're letters that I mean to open. And so you can ask your dentist, you can check on your MyGov, and if you're getting that family tax benefit, you most likely will be eligible.
Who generally gets the family tax benefit A?
So these are people whose income is at a lower level. Yeah.
Right. So if you've got that, then can you do it in retrospect if someone's listening and they go, oh gosh, I haven't been claiming that?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that. If it's just recent, perhaps it's possible, but I'd encourage you to get on there now and find out. Ask your dentist, ask your get on the internet and Google it and find out what you might be able to access.
So dentists should know, in other words.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ask your dentist. Elizabeth Devaney is here with me. It's 27 minutes past 11. We're talking about saving you money in the healthcare system. How else can we save some money?
Well, I thought about the patient transport systems, especially now because petrol's become very expensive.
Of course.
And if you have to travel for care, there are schemes that will help you cover the costs. And again, most people haven't heard of these.
So what are the names? How would we look? How would we find out? And how would we see if we're eligible?
Yeah, so in Victoria, it's called the Victorian Patient and Accommodation Scheme. Just to give you an idea, if you've got to travel more than 100k one way or 500k in a week, they'll give you about $50 a night for accommodation, $50 a day for rideshare, things like that. And a lot of people don't know about it. If you've never heard of it, you're not alone. This is one of the least known supports in the system.
So that will help all of us who live in the regions, obviously, a great deal. Is that who mostly takes it up?
Yes, absolutely. And maybe someone in your community has told you about it and you know. But for those that don't know, ask your doctor about this next time you need to take an appointment outside of town.
Anne is asking, can a pharmacy retrospectively enlist you for the safety net for 2026 now that we're nearly 5 months into the year?
If you've been going to the same one and they have a record of your prescriptions, it's possible. But generally it's from when you start, so when you register.
Right. So they won't. So you do it today and mostly they will register there. Mm. Can you ask them to do it in retrospect, do you think?
So the thing is, it's about records. Do they have records of what happened? Are they accurate? So that's why it's normally done from the day that you register.
You would hope they have records.
Yeah, but it's also about how much you've spent and so on. And you might have gone to one pharmacy and then one that's owned by maybe the same people somewhere else. So then it gets complicated. I think the rules are generally the day you register, off you go.
Mm. This on text as well. If you can possibly do it, pay your health insurance for a year. This way saves 2 months' fees, a considerable amount of money.
Yes, some health insurers, like your general insurers, will offer you a better benefit if you pay up front. Another good thing to do to save money on your insurance, your health insurance, is to check that it's still the right one for you. Sometimes you'll find one with the same kind of policy cheaper somewhere else.
How easy is it to compare those?
Yeah, not so easy. There is a great government website called privatehealth.gov.au, which is really good at helping you walk through what kind of insurance you might need and what the options are. That's a good place to start.
You are listening to Elizabeth Devaney, who's giving you heaps of good tips. I'm writing some of them down myself for my own life. She's from the Consumer Health Forum on 774 ABC Melbourne. This also on text. Could you ask if one uses multiple pharmacies, do you need to register for Safety Net with each of them?
Yeah.
And then how does that then combine, I would say as well?
Okay, so I don't know, Mary, do you remember being at school and there was a Lamington Drive and you'd have that form you filled out and people would buy the Lamingtons? You can go to the Department of Health, the Federal Department of Health website, and download a form just like that. You take it from pharmacy to pharmacy, and many people do that to get their best price. And each pharmacist has to sign it and stamp it, and you add it up, and then when you've got to the amount, so if it's $277, then you submit it to the government. So you can do it yourself. It's just a lot of work.
You have to do it yourself. That is, dare I say, Elizabeth, very analogue for these days.
It is. What? It's a bit 20th century, isn't it?
downloading, printing out, taking it around with petrol that you can't afford, and that's how you're supposed to save money.
Yes. So we've been advocating for a decade for the government to automate this, and we're still advocating for that because actually the government knows how much you spend on the PBS. So everybody knows if you met the safety net. We did a great piece of work with some of your colleagues last year to show that about 500,000 Australians met the safety net but never used it and so paid full price when they didn't need to.
Oh, that just hurts me thinking about it. Please, everyone, let's go out and do this. Catherine, you've called in from Hawthorne. What did you want to say?
Oh, hello. This is Catherine from Three White Care Mart in Hawthorne. I'm a pharmacist. And I just wanted to clarify that when patients come into the pharmacy, they don't necessarily have to register for their safety net report. We just are able to produce most of the dispense systems now. I can actually look at a patient's safety net total that they've spent in the pharmacy that year and can just give them a printout. If they only come to our pharmacy, our system automatically prompts when they reach the safety net. But quite often I may have a patient that, say, has been in hospital and they want their total of their PBS medications that they've had in hospital. We then contact the hospital and get a safety net report from them and then add it into our dispense system.
Right,
so I just wanted to clarify that patients don't necessarily need to register for the safety net.
You mean they don't necessarily? It depends on the pharmacy. Is that what you're saying, Catherine?
Well, almost 100% of the dispense software that we all work with in community pharmacy have the ability just to do a print safety net print for the patient. They don't need to register per se.
That's interesting, Catherine. And so from your experience, do you find that a lot of people are missing out or don't know and that you have to be more proactive with them?
I think it's certainly a lot easier for patients that are loyal to the one pharmacy. And we always let patients know as soon as they hit the safety net if they are regular patients at our pharmacy or if they're getting close to it.
Yeah.
I think the issue comes because systems are not integrated across different pharmacies, that Mrs. Jones goes to another pharmacy in Camberwell and she also comes to my pharmacy in Hawthorne, she may not be aware that both systems don't add up together.
Yeah, and Mrs. Jones would be, you know, among many who would have the right to do that. Elizabeth, is that what we need as well? Those pharmacies and their systems talking to one another?
Yeah, we do hear from people who say that they didn't know they'd hit the safety net. That's pretty common. And that often younger people aren't even told by their GP or their pharmacist that it exists. I think if you take a lot of medicines regularly, some health professional might click and go, oh, did you know about this?
Yep.
But if that's not your history, they tend not to mention it.
We have to go soon, Elizabeth, but any last-minute tips for people?
Just pharmacists can do more than fill scripts, I'd just add. They can do more than people realise. They can do emergency refills of scripts, medical certificates, vaccines and more, and that's often cheaper than you'd do at other places too, so check that out as well.
Elizabeth, you're saving people money. Well done. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Elizabeth Devaney is CEO of Consumer Health Forum. Now, a pretty amazing race happened overnight. Sub-2-hour marathon. How quick are they going to get?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Did you hear about the first person to run a marathon in under 2 hours? Well, there wasn't just one of them. Two of them did it in the London Marathon. Kenyan Sebastian Sawe and Yomif Kejelcha, they both set a new world record and went sub 2 hours. Joining us now is, of course, marathon legend himself, Steve Monoghetti, who's going to tell us just how quick can we get. Hi, Mono, how are you going?
Hi, Mary. Good, thank you. I'm in a bit of shock. We're all in a bit of shock, I think, that it's finally happened. We probably anticipated it happening, but wow, to have two go under and three go under the world record has just been incredible.
It is incredible. So you've been obviously in the athletics world. This is a real psychological, apart from anything else, as well as a physical landmark.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, we've heard about super shoes, and the times have been coming down rapidly. But I suppose we didn't really think that that, you know, there was Kipchoge, but he's probably at the tail end of his career, and Calvin Kiptum, who held the world record, tragically died. So we've sort of been thinking, well, maybe it won't happen as quickly as what we thought. But then overnight, the conditions in London were just really conducive to fast times, and away they went.
And London's not supposed to be fast, is it?
No. So the world records kind of was used to be in Rotterdam, and then it kind of went to Berlin, and Berlin and Chicago have swapped it, and there's sort of no elevation there. But London has tried. They took out the cobblestones and they tried to make it really fast, but generally it hasn't been a world record course. But yesterday, the second half was a nice conducive wind, and you know, Sarway ran under an hour for the second half of the marathon, which, you know, was incredible. We were trying to break an hour for the half marathon just on its own, let alone doing it in the second half of a marathon. It's just hard to comprehend.
So for the record, so to speak, it's 1 hour, 59:30, and here is audio of that finish.
He's going to do it. We are going to see a legal sub-2-hour marathon to Sebastian Sarway. It's the
Wow, indeed. Wow. Mona, I need to ask about these shoes, because these, the two fellas who broke the 2 hours, both wearing shoes, well, we may as well say what they are, they're Adidas, they weigh 97 grams, apparently. Is this the winged keel that we're talking about here? How much could we put down to the shoes?
Well, they have certainly improved the time. You don't get tired in the back end, and that's what Sarway did. He ran from 30 to 40K. He ran under 28 minutes, which is world-class 10K running, let alone doing it. And normally what's happening, or what used to happen, Mary, was you'd run out of glycogen, you'd get tired, and your legs would really get fatigued, and you couldn't, you know, they'd get so fatigued that you had to slow down, or you just were happy to hold the pace. But these super shoes with this sort of bouncing foam on the front of them, they give you, they've got a rocker and you roll onto your front and then the sort of foam bounces back so you don't get as fatigued. So they're running so quick at the back end now, and you don't notice this when they cross the finish line. They're not, you know, they're sort of still bouncing along and being able to do interviews and talk freely, whereas the human body used to run out of glycogen and not be able to finish as strongly as what they do. So they have, and they've given runners confidence. The other thing, Mary, that people don't realise is they also allow athletes to recover so much better so they can train at a high level. So in their preparation, they've been able to absorb a lot more training. So when you take your training to another level, that obviously then reflects in your racing after that training block.
And it all compounds. So, Mona, the question then is, if we're going in this direction, how fast can we get? How fast can a human body get if you've got that technology?
Well, you're probably asking the wrong person, because I didn't think we'd ever run under 2 hours.
But oh, really?
There's technology that's always going to come into sport, but really the marathon's pretty pure. I mean, your shoes contact the ground, but there's not a lot of other stuff, you know, with sports science and things. There's nutrition, but generally it's just the, you know, it's the human body just pushing itself. So I don't know how much quicker they can go. So I didn't think they'd run this fast, but sorry, I just think, you know, with technology now, you still got to have the human person able to do it. So I'm not sure we can run much quicker, to be honest. And the conditions were so good in London.
You think it's exceptional. Are you a little bit jealous, Mona?
No, I love that the world is just, you know, we had Ballarat Marathon yesterday, and so many people are running now and discovering the great benefits that I've espoused for many, many years. I'm just delighted that it's getting so much attention and people are loving being involved and doing it at their own level. And recreational running's just going off, and we have the fastest in the world, but we also have people just, you know, running marathons in droves around the world. And I'm just so delighted to see it.
How much do you still run, Mona?
Oh, every day. When I have calves and overuse issues, but generally I'm out most days, so I'm
how
hanging
far
in there. Oh, about 10K a day.
About 10K a day. Lazy 10K a day. Mona, thank you. I hope you haven't lost too much money on a bet there about not going below 2 hours.
No, I'm okay. I'm delighted. And thanks for the support and the attention. It's great. It's exciting for the athletics world to have that 2 hour mark broken. I never thought it'd happen, so we're celebrating it.
There you go. Steve Monteghetti didn't think it could happen, but it's happened. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mary. See ya.
Steve Monaghetti, of course, marathon legend. And this is, as he says, a golden age of athletics and awareness of athletics, particularly in Australia. And why wouldn't we celebrate the sub-2-hour marathon? Well, overnight, we saw some pretty shocking things in Washington, D.C. That's not putting off Camilla and Charles.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, after a dramatic 12 hours in Washington, D.C., where a shooter got shockingly close to the U.S. president and senior officials, King Charles and Queen Camilla are keeping calm and carrying on their tour of the U.S. and here to chat about how important this is for both the King and the president. I'm joined by former NBC journalist, Emmy Award-winning journalist and just all-round great expert on the U.S., Sarah James.
Hey, nice to see you.
Lovely to see you. We'll get to the shooting in a moment, but Sarah, this was already controversial, wasn't it? Many people in the U.K. were already questioning the seamlessness of this visit in the midst of the war because tensions between the UK and the US are high. But that's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is the whole point. Of course, you know, this is kind of bracketed by this big event that's coming up in the United States, the 250th anniversary of American independence. You know, independence from, the country that is sending over King Charles.
My great-great-granddaddy.
Exactly. Well, in fact, King Charles is a direct descendant of the king who was on the throne, George III, when the Revolutionary War occurred. So, you know, there's all kinds. So that's the backdrop, if you will, the magisterial backdrop. Mm-hmm. But you're right. The reason I believe that the king has accepted this invitation from President Trump is because the so-called special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom is really at a low ebb. The president has made disparaging remarks about everything from British military to the prime minister. In fact, he has said on more than one occasion that British Prime Minister Keir Starmer is, quote unquote, no Winston Churchill. So some really, you know, stark comments. And these have not been received well in the United Kingdom, unsurprisingly, both inside Westminster, but also very much among rank and file people. You know, friends of mine, I bet friends of yours over there have told Indeed. You what they think.
Well, exactly. It is not only the seamliness from a sort of diplomatic point of view, but this idea that people, their king is going over to essentially play nice.
Yeah, curry favor. Is that what, you know, is that what's happening here? And here's the nub of it, though. I think that both countries at the other levels recognize that it would be great to have a reset. And in fact, Prime Minister Starmer himself, far from kind of poo-pooing this and saying, no, he shouldn't go, has said quite the opposite. No, it's go right ahead. You should go. And I think the reason for that is that this kind of increasing tension that comes in the wake of the war that the United States and Israel began in Iran, and where the U.S. president asked for the use of bases and then mm-hmm. was very frustrated with the response. There have been criticisms of NATO. There have been criticisms of Britain. And there is a feeling that this particular president has a real soft spot for people who wear a crown.
Well, indeed, President Trump has actually said he wanted to be a king at some point, didn't he? So it's just envy. He's just getting the real deal over and seeing what he can learn.
Well, what he has said is that, you know, his mother was born or was from Scotland, from the Isle of Lewis. He has a real appreciation for royalty. There's no doubt about that. There's certainly been many people in the United States who have questioned what the job title description is that he really wants. But the reality is there is no doubt that he likes the royals. He in particular liked King Charles's mother, Queen Elizabeth, who visited the United States many times. I believe the most recent visit was in 2007, but she was in the United States for the 200th anniversary back in 1976. So there is a tradition of British royals, you know, the fight was a long time ago And maybe some people threw some tea into the harbor. And maybe there were some, you know, there were some fisticuffs involved in a war that lasted some years. But that's ancient history.
Ancient history, especially when you've got, you know, the images of Princess Di still in living memory, dancing around with John Travolta. You know, there's a fine history there, isn't there?
So. Oh, the royals, you know, let's be very honest here. President Trump isn't the only one in the United States who likes the royals and has a little bit of a thing for them. So, you know, for a proud Democratic Republic, there are a lot of people in the United States who sure do like a little dash of royalty.
You're hearing a little dash of Sarah James on 774 ABC Melbourne. We're talking about the royal tour to Washington, D.C. Sarah, there's just so many awkward elephants in this particular room, not least of which is Jeffrey Epstein, of course. A one-time close friend of the president's and also of the king's brother. Awkward for both of them.
Well, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, formerly Prince Andrew, was, of course, a friend with Epstein. And there's that famous photograph that everybody knows about. And if you want to talk about the things that neither King Charles nor President Trump would like to discuss, I think you can put that at the top of the list. I think you can make a very safe assumption that when King Charles addresses Congress, that's not what he's going to be talking about. So, I mean, they really, and I think that does not mean there won't be questions about it, because the United States, as you know, has a vibrant, feisty news gathering group, and I suspect there will be questions about it. But for the president and for the king, it's going to be all about the ceremony. It's going to be all about that state dinner. It's going to be all about that speech to Congress. And right now, it's going to be all about security.
We know that Buckingham Palace has confirmed that the king and queen aren't going to meet with survivors during the visit because they're saying it might jeopardize legal proceedings. But on the other hand, the king can't ignore it altogether, can he? I'm hearing that survivors are going to be staking out where he's going, and not just the members of the media, but survivors themselves will be pressing the king to at least do something, even symbolic.
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and I don't know how exactly it's going to play out, because the reality is, how is this visit going to be clamped down even more in the wake of what happened Indeed. At the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So I think, you know, we know that officials with the, you know, the King's team and the President's men and women have met together. The security apparatus are working at a high level to ensure, they've said that the visit is going on and that it will be safe and secure. You know, just one more bit of background on this. You know, this is a live relationship with conversations all the time between the United States and the United Kingdom at a very high security level. Both nations are part of Five Eyes, that security arrangement that also includes Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. So there's a lot of exchange of information. So I think, you know, there are so many things that are going to be on the table to discuss. And it is a democracy, and there may be people coming forward with questions of their own that they want to ask. And we'll see how that plays out.
Going to the shooting, what are your reflections about what this says about violence in the US? Or can it be, in fact, decoupled from violent attempts against the president himself? I mean, this is the fourth. I think it's the fourth if you count the one in Mar-a-Lago where he wasn't there.
I think when he's not there, I think.
Yeah, maybe. Okay.
I'm not sure.
Third or fourth.
But, you know, but yeah, I don't mean to parse.
No.
Because the reality is, you're quite right that there have been multiple attempts. It would appear. I mean, again, we still don't know with this most recent attack on the White House Correspondents' Dinner. The suspect is going to be arraigned tomorrow morning, U.S. time. So, you know, it does look like from writings of the suspect that he was targeting members of the administration. But, you know, we'll wait to see what all the facts say. But let's pull back from that. You're right. There has been a lot. This president has engendered a lot of very strong feelings. And indeed, in a lengthy news conference last night, right after the attempted attack there at the Correspondents' Dinner, the president, when asked about this, said, you know, well, quote unquote, impactful presidents are the ones who get this to happen, and then kind of associated himself, mentioned Lincoln's name.
Like it was a badge of honor.
He said, I'm not going to say it's an honor, but. And what I would say is the United States, unfortunately, has a terrible history of assassinations, both successful and ones which were attempts, as such as the one in 1981 at the exact
same hotel,
right? So it's not something that is new in American political life, but I want to be very clear. You know, I'm an American. I lived there. I grew up there. I'm back and forth all the time. I was there 5 times last year. I would say that the rhetoric that we hear now, it just feels so much more combustible. And for the people who are frustrated and disappointed and, you know, that it really is a lot of logs on a pretty well burning fire. And that has to concern all of us, because the reality is we want to live in a free and fair and open democratic republic. I mean, that's the goal, right? And when I see people and talk to people all across the political spectrum, there is a growing level of anxiety about how we go forward. And, you know, concern from parents about their children's active shooter drills at their schools, concerns from politicians who are concerned that they might be targeted, concerns from judges about the fact that we have also had judges who have been shot and sadly killed. And these are times in the United States where trying to figure out how to bring that down really has to be front and center.
You've obviously got such deep ongoing ties there, and you say you're going back and forth all the time. How do you feel when you're going back? How's that feeling changed over the past year?
Well, I love the United States with all my heart. I mean, I'm a proud dual citizen. Our older daughter lives in the United States, so our ties are pretty darn deep. I think the reality of living in a democracy is you get to say, I like this, I don't like that, I want this to be better. And would I like for the political rhetoric to calm down? Yes, I would. And, and I hope that happens. I think it's important that it's being, that people are paying attention to it. And I hope that we see it, settle on down.
Always lovely to talk to you, Sarah James. Thank you.
It is a pleasure.
I'm an Englishman.
Yes, an English man and English woman going to New York. New York City is on the tour, as is Washington, D.C. and Virginia. But this on text, enough of Donald Trump. He's taken up way too much space on the airwaves and newsprint. We don't need to know about this dreadful behaviour. The emperor has no clothes. We all know this. Many thanks, of course, to Sarah James, who has taken us through those headlines. It's going to be an interesting one to watch, whether or not we like Donald Trump. A lot of awkward things, lots of elephants in that particular room. Earlier this hour, we were talking about road safety. Got a whole heap of news this morning talking about motorcyclists able to use bus lanes. We've got potholes being filled and resurfaced as part of a pre-election sweetening package. I was asking, are our roads actually safer now that we have potentially fewer people on the road with the fuel crisis and free public transport? Well, we heard that, in fact, potholes aren't considered a safety risk when we were talking earlier. This on text, if potholes aren't considered a safety risk for Victoria's roads, I guess we need to see it as yet another tax on Victorian drivers. Someone needs to pay for the damage to cars or damage to the road. Maybe with bigger gas-guzzling four-wheel drives with pothole-resistant tyres, then we'll fix all our problems, right? That on text, reduce truck numbers, a few texts about trucks as well. Bob says, let's not forget that trucks damage roads, not cars. It's all about weight distribution. We aren't getting very good at getting heavy freight off the roads and onto the rails. Also, we were talking about how to save money in the healthcare system. Jeff says that he looked into the travel support scheme but found he was ineligible as he was in a clinical trial for cancer treatment. That's an interesting point, Jeff. We were talking about the Victorian Patient Transport Assistance Scheme. And I think we need to get Elizabeth Devaney back because there's still so many questions that we didn't get to, and apologies for that. This on text, though, assistance scheme did help this texter that gave me $5.67 for a return trip to Ballarat. Should have been $105.67, but they took $100 off because I don't have a healthcare card. And this as well on text about our situation when it comes to the fuel crisis and public transport. John says, I planned and pre-booked V-Line tickets several weeks ago to travel from Wodonga to Melbourne last weekend. In light of the increased overcrowding experienced on the Albury-Melbourne line, I elected to drive to Melbourne instead. My 85-year-old parents have also changed their original pre-booked train travel plans from Albury to Melbourne today to commute by car for the same reason. Are we all being driven back onto the roads after all? I'd love to keep hearing your thoughts. Please write to me at conversationhour@abc.net.au about any of the topics we've covered today, anything you think we should be covering. And for joining me in all of those conversations, you can listen again to them on the ABC Listen app. Just look up The Conversation Hour. And please do write to me, conversationhour@abc.net.au. Take care.